I'd like to call the Health and Human Services Division to order. Members are drifting in, but I'd like to get started because we have a lot of ground to cover. And so just would like to note today that I have another substitute committee administrator with me, Owen Wirth, and we appreciate his being willing to help us out today. And again, Mr. McQuillan will be starting with the committee at the end of the week. So we've got one more substitute tomorrow, and then we'll be good. But thank you for your help today. So I think that a quorum is present, and we can get started with the presentation. We're continuing with the presentation from House Research. And members, you should have in your packet, if you kept it, you should have the document that was given out at the last meeting, which we're going to continue. It's the slide packet. And if you don't have it, we do have some extras. Oh, and I've just been reminded, even though we don't have a script, that we actually do have minutes to approve. And you should have those in your packet. And would a member
like to? So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Hamilton. Okay, with that, we will move right on into the presentation. And I think it would be helpful as we go through if we could just from time to time remind us what slide we're on, because they're not always really easy to see, and we want to make sure that everybody's able to follow in their packets. So that would be great. So if you would please introduce yourself for the record, and we'll get started.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research. As you can see from the screen, oh, here's our computer person right now. If you could have maybe one short minute to get the presentation.
Ms. Clarkvist, while we're waiting, could you just remind us where we are in the packet?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, we are on slide 63. The heading at the top is chemical and mental health, and then right below that it says Minnesota Sex Offender Program, MSOP.
Okay, and that is on page 32 of the PAC members. Thank you. And just as a reminder, Mr. Wirth just reminded me, as we did in the last meeting, if members would try to hold your questions until the end of a section. However, if you have a question that you need answered right away, like what is that acronym, or I can't read what slide we're on, or something like that, please do raise your hand, and we'll let you interrupt with those. But anything more substantive, the sections aren't that long, and it would be great if we could wait till the end of each one, and our staff will let us know when that is, and then we can see if we have questions on that before we move on. Ready to go?
Yes.
All right, Ms.
Clarkvist. Madam Chair and members, we'll start with slide 63. This is the last slide in the chemical and mental health section, and this just briefly describes the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, which is part of the jurisdiction of the Department of Human Services. This is a court-ordered treatment program for individuals who have been civilly committed by the court as sexually dangerous persons or as having a sexual psychopathic personality. And individuals receive services either on the Moose Lake campus or on the St. Peter campus. Over the past few years, there's been a federal lawsuit related to the constitutionality of this program. And recently, the Eighth Circuit upheld the constitutionality of the program, and cert to the Supreme Court was denied. So currently, the program is operational.
So, Ms. Clark, that's the end of that section.
Yes, it is.
So are there any questions for members on the MSOP program? So I just wanted to make a brief comment about that. Members might be surprised to see this in the HHS committee, because often people might think of it as a criminal justice type of a program, but you know, the reason, and staff, please correct me if I'm say anything that isn't correct here, but when we, these are people who are being held usually after the expiration of their criminal penalties. And so they're civilly committed under the explanation, I guess, best word I could come up with, that they are somehow in need of, that they're in need of treatment and that they're going to be receiving treatment in our program for these conditions that they have. And that is the, what makes it constitutional to hold them is that they are receiving treatment. They're not getting a criminal sanction as they, so that we are able to hold them beyond the expiration of their sentences. And that's why it's before this committee, because people who are in this program, at least in theory, are supposed to be treated so that one day they will be recovered and be able to be released. So I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you. You could continue.
Madam Chair and members, Danielle Pinelli from House Research, and I'm going to be continuing on with the income assistance and housing programs. And I'll just mention here a couple things at the beginning before I start going through the specific programs. Some of the material I'm going to be going through is actually issue areas that are covered by Sarah Sunderman, who is out on parental leave right now. So the child support, child welfare, and program integrity sections are things that Sarah would normally cover. And the other thing that I was going to mention as I go through these, there should be in your packets, or there was yesterday, a handout that lists House Research publications in Health and Human Services. So if members are interested in getting more detail on any of these programs, we have a lot of publications that are available on our website, or we can also get you a paper copy if you'd prefer. And one of the publications that Mr. Chun and I routinely put out is this Minnesota Family Assistance Guide, which is a big guidebook that includes the health care programs that Mr. Chun went through in committee yesterday and the income assistance programs that I'll be going through now. So that's a good resource for people that are interested in more detail. The first program that I'm going to go through is the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or MFIP as it's called. This is what is typically thought of as Minnesota's welfare program. It's a jointly funded federal-state program designed to provide income assistance to eligible low-income families, and the assistance includes cash and food assistance, employment and training services, and related support services. Minnesota must meet federal temporary assistance to needy families, or TANF, laws and regulations, but has a considerable amount of flexibility in how we design our program. As most of the human services programs are, this is a state-supervised, county-administered program, and it is the counties that accept applications and make eligibility determinations for the program. There are several requirements that people need to meet in order to be eligible, and this slide just lists the major eligibility requirements. The one that I'll just touch on briefly is that the MFIP program and TANF requires the family to have a minor child or a pregnant woman in the household. TANF regulations also limit assistance to 60 months. However, there are certain exceptions and exemptions around people being determined to be ill or incapacitated or hard to employ. TANF regulations also require states to meet certain work participation rates. The activities that are counted for work are specified in state statute, and they range from unsubsidized employment to pre-employment activities, including chemical and mental health assessments, treatment, and services. Uh, MFIP applicants need to meet an initial income test that excludes certain items from income. In general, a family is eligible for MFIP if their income, after all the applicable deductions are made, is below the MFIP income standard for a family of like size. And so as an example, for a family of three, the income standard is $984 per month. There's also an asset standard. In order to be eligible for MFIP, the equity value of property must not exceed $10,000 for applicants and participants. And then the slide also includes information about what is included in the definition of personal property. So the benefits, as far as cash assistance is concerned, a family of three on MFIP with no income from work would receive the standard benefit of $984 each month, which is made up of two different components. There's a cash component of $532 a month and then a food component of $452 a month. Families on MFIP with earned income continue to receive an income grant, but it would be less than or equal to the amount they received if they were not working. And to encourage work, there's an earned income disregard that is used in the program. As earnings approach the exit level, which is about 130% of the federal poverty guidelines for a family of three, the family's grant would be reduced down to zero. And then this next slide just shows some funding and enrollment numbers for fiscal year 2018. And I'll just mention here that the federal number is a combination of federal TANF funds and federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program funding.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if you can comment on the length of time that Minnesotans spend enrolled in this program, if you've got averages and if you've got information about how long people are eligible to be on MFIP.
Madam Chair, Representative Halverson, I know that that's something that the Department of Human Services tracks. I haven't seen a number recently, but I'm sure DHS has that, and I could follow up with them to get that. My recollection is that it's somewhere in the range of 2 to 3 years, but I'll check and get back to you.
Okay. Thank you, Halverson. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that would be helpful because I think historically we've looked at numbers that people are eligible for a certain number of years, and Minnesotans tend to use half if it, or less of that benefit. So I just want us to be clear about the fact that Minnesotans are getting out of the program more quickly than they're required to.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Were there any other questions for members?
Right here.
Oh, yeah.
Thank Representative you, Madam Chair. I just had a quick, as I'm looking at the benefits, it says there's $532 a month in cash and $452 a month in food for a family of three. When was the last time that was changed or increased?
Madam Chair and Spinelli. Members, the food amount is adjusted annually when the federal SNAP benefits are adjusted. The cash amount has not been adjusted for quite some time. I believe the last time the cash number was adjusted was in the late 1980s.
Thank you so much.
Representative Bacon.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I don't think the $532 includes the housing assistance grant that some would qualify for. Is that covered in the housing section that we'll be getting into?
Ms. Pugnelli.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, no, I don't think that includes the housing piece under MFIP. I didn't go into that here because this is a fairly high-level overview, but that is correct that within the MFIP program, there's also a housing assistance piece for families that meet certain criteria. I think they can get a housing assistance grant of up to about $110 a month.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, it certainly isn't enough to begin to cover costs anywhere in the state if you look at the cost of particularly rental housing. But it is another contribution.
Representative Neuer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, where does DWP fit into the MFIT program?
Ms. Pugnelli.
Madam Chair and Representative Neuer, that is another sort of subcomponent of MFIP. DWP is the Diversionary Work Program, and typically when someone initially applies for MFIP, if they don't have any major barriers to employment, they might be sort of shifted over into a fast-track program, DWP, where they would get up to 4 months of assistance to try to get them employed quickly and then not even go on the regular MFIT program at all.
Representative Neuer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to inquire about that.
Great. Thank you very much. And Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just a question on the food part of that. How is that mandated? Is that mandated where they get food assistance from a certain source, or is that regulated at all, or are they just given a $432 earmarked for food?
Ms. Pugnelli?
Madam Chair and members, the food portion is typically funded through the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which was formerly food stamps. Okay. And the benefits that a family receives through MFIP are loaded onto an electronic benefit transfer card, and the cash and the food portions are segregated on that card so that the food amount can only be used for SNAP-approved food under the federal SNAP program.
Thank you.
Representative Bierman, any further question? Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had some questions on eligibility. On slide 73, I think in 74, the wording is specific to talk about that the applicant must be a Minnesota resident and a U.S. citizen. Is it the same for the recipient of these benefits? So it looks like one person in the household is the applicant, but it applies to the benefits apply to everyone in the household. Are the beneficiaries also held to the same standard?
Representative Munson, are you talking about 73 and 74? Because we haven't gotten to those.
I'm sorry, slide, is it page 37?
Oh, 37.
Page 37 and slide 73?
Yeah, but she hasn't talked about that yet. We're still back on MFIP. So maybe if you could hold that question until we get there. We're kind of held up at, we just finished 71, and that's kind of what we're talking about.
Okay.
So we'll keep your name on the list, and we'll call on you for that right after we get there. And so if other members don't have questions about this, I wanted to just make a comment about this, because I want to flag this for members, because I think you will be seeing legislation on it this year. As was mentioned, this cash grant, $532 a month, has not been raised. The year I'm always told is 1986. So think about how long ago that was, and that this amount of cash has not increased. And I think that it will be a good time for members to learn a little bit more about this program. If it wasn't clear, we get from the federal government a grant, a block grant, called the TANF grant, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. This grant is used for all kinds of stuff besides the cash that is supposed to go to the families. And over the years, and it's been used for a lot of very good things, often relating to sort of the same population. But because the funds have been used in that way, and probably also for political reasons, the cash grant has not gone up. There have been attempts here over the recent years, coming from both sides of the aisle, to raise the cash. I think there's a general recognition that pretty much nobody can live on $532 a month, and I'd like to ask Ms. Pugnelli to speak in a moment to what is supposed to be covered with that cash. And I think the answer probably is everything except the food and any additional food you might need. So it's not very much money. So I just want to flag that for members. And also, if you look back to a previous slide that shows where the money's going in Health and Human Services, and its slide, let me see, it was on page 2 of the packet. And there's a slide that shows various pots of money. And it's, you can see the slice that goes to, let's see, MFIP and the DWP, Diversionary Work Program, that Ms. Pugnelli was just talking about, 1.1% of our expenditures. So, you know, often the public has a real misconception about this. People are like, oh, all our money is going to welfare. And if they mean this, they are sadly, they are very much mistaken, because very little of our money is going to this. So I just want to flag that for members while we're going through. And if there are questions on that or further comments, I'd be glad to take them. Representative Kunesh-Podein. Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this isn't a question, but this is to share a little bit of something when we're talking about these resources that we're providing to families that are in need. In 1986, which is, you know, what we hear is the last time this cash was adjusted, I actually was on welfare. And it's very ironic. It was due to the fact that there was a shutdown, a government shutdown. I had just finished my student teaching in December. I had just enough money to get me through the end of the year. I had a job set up with Minneapolis to teach, start my teaching. The government went on strike or shutdown, and I couldn't get my teaching license. And here I was, a single mom, three kids, and no way to get my license, no job, and pretty much, you know, out of cash, out of money, everything. And if it wasn't for these kind of programs that were there, that Minnesota had set up as a safety net for families, you know, such as myself or those that find themselves in need, I could have easily lost my home and not been able to take care of my children. I was able to get on Minnesota Care for the first time, and they were able to get the kind of medical attention. And it took me years to recover from that kind of a situation. So I know there are folks that think there are people out there that take advantage of these situations, that live, you know, make this a way of life and that sort of thing. But it is so important that you recognize that Minnesota has taken care of their families and my family for situations that are beyond our control. And one of the reasons I ran for office was in order to ensure that these safety nets were there and were available. And it really almost breaks my heart when I see that, you know, how many years ago that same cash amount that just barely got me through a month is still what is expected in this day and age. And I really hope that as we go through this and as we create really good policy for Minnesota, that we take into consideration the that it's not always people trying to take advantage of the state, but we're really here to make sure that those resources and those safety nets are there for families. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to we're going to have a lot more time to discuss this, because we're going to have bills, and I know this is a really important topic to folks, but we're going to try to move on and get through some of this and get to Representative Munson's question as well. So please continue.
Madam Chair and members, we're on slide 72 now, beginning the General Assistance Program discussion. General assistance is a state program that provides cash assistance to low-income single adults and childless couples who fall into specified statutory categories and who meet the eligibility requirements, including income and asset requirements of the program. So this would be for people who don't have a minor child in the household, so wouldn't be eligible for MFIP. Eligibility is primarily defined in terms of disability and unemployability, and again, this is a program that's state-supervised and administered by the counties. So in addition to having a financial need, applicants and recipients need to be residents of Minnesota, ineligible for federal aid programs, citizens of the United States and then meet other eligibility requirements that I'll show you on the next couple of slides. So as I mentioned, in order to be eligible for this program, a person needs to fall into one of several specified statutory categories that have to do with either disability or unemployability. And this slide and the next one just lists what those statutory categories are. Slide number 76 goes over the income standards for the general assistance program.
Ms. Cunielli, you know, since Representative Munson had asked about this, let's pause here so that we can, because your question pertained to exactly to this, right?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And, well, I was starting to catch the wording back when we were talking about the MFIT program, about the eligibility requirements back on slide 67 that goes through what the requirements for the program are. I assume that is it all recipients of the MFIT program must meet these the bullet points on slide 67, and is it the same for this program for the general assistance that where it says applicant must be a U.S. citizen, but is it the recipients also have to?
Madam Chair, yep. Representative Munson, yes, once you're on the program, you'd have to continue to meet the eligibility requirements to remain on the program.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Madam Chair and members, slide 76 relates to general assistance income standards. And so in order to receive general assistance, an individual's net income needs to be less than the monthly income standard, which is $203 a month for an individual and $260 a month for a couple. And then this slide also kind of details how income is calculated when determining eligibility for this program. The next slide relates to GA asset standards. And these are the same as the asset standards for the MFIT program. In order to be eligible for general assistance, the equity value of personal property must not exceed $10,000. And then below on the slide is a listing of what is included in personal property. Slide number 78 just lays out the benefit amounts for different households. And slide 79 provides some information about general assistance funding and enrollment for fiscal year 2018.
Thank you, Ms. Cunielli. So let's pause there as well. I have a question for you, and I don't know if other members do, but my question would be, well, first of all, I think it's worth flagging that this is a state-funded program. Whereas TANF funds for MFIP are federal funds. But when's the last time we raised any of these amounts? Because, boy, if you were living on $203 a month, that is not a lot of money.
Madam Chair and members, I don't know what year these numbers were last updated. I think for as long as I have covered this subject area, they've been the $203 and $260 a month.
And Ms. Cunielli, is there a time limit for people to be on GA benefits, general assistance?
Madam Chair, no, there's not a time limit for this program.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from members? Yeah, Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, do we have any program outcome studies from this particular program? Like, does that amount of money actually, does it bring people out of poverty? Does it keep people alive? Does it keep them working? Do we have anything to say that $203 a month is something that actually makes a difference?
Madam Chair, Representative Mann, I haven't seen anything like that, but I could certainly check with DHS to see if they have any reports that have information like that included.
Thank you. And I think that would be actually an excellent thing for when we hear from DHS, too. We'll be sure to get input from them on that. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess the one question I'd have is there a one-page summary of all the different programs, state and federal, that you can qualify for, where you could summarize, you know, whether it's a family of three or a family of four? Maybe that's coming up here, or maybe it's in our packet. I'm not sure. Oh, okay. Because, you know, I mean, you see, and I want to help people. You know, I did 13 years of jail ministry. And I own an independent insurance agency, and I write checks out to people to cover their deductibles and other things for them that are low income. So I want to help people who need help. But I do, you know, I do want to get an overall perspective of how much, how many programs are available. If we're duplicating things, maybe we should increase in one area and eliminate in another area. I mean, the programs seem to come from so many different directions that it, like we started out in the committee, it's a little bit confusing and overwhelming. So I'll look this summary page over and see if that helps me better understand the overall picture. But I certainly appreciate your presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Munson, did you want to say something more? I have you on the list. We weren't sure if you had raised your hand.
Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on slide number 78, the bottom line. One adult living in a medical facility, I was contacted by a constituent about this. He is pretty much living in a wheelchair. He has a number of health effects that are debilitating for him. He has the opportunity to make a little money, which he would like to buy gifts and things for his nursing staff to tend to him. I'm just wondering if there's a waiver on that $99 in any way, shape, or form that he could take advantage of opportunities out there, that he could manage to earn a little bit more money, or would he be thrown off this program?
Ms. Pignelli?
Madam Chair and members, this line is for one adult that would be living in a medical facility or in a group residential housing setting, and I think what happens in those situations is that whatever money that the person has is going to go toward paying for their care, except for this $99, which is the MA personal needs allowance.
So
it's pretty a stringent requirement that I understand ground rules are there, but just wondered if there was any opportunity there or not.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Pignelli. And I think, Representative Bierman, I think you could, you know, we could probably our constituent services staff or, you know, that might be a question to ask DHS as well.
Thank you.
Okay. And just, Ms. Pignelli, before we move on, I think that this general assistance is a program that people don't hear about as much and may not be familiar with. And I know that this is, it's probably hard to talk about sort of the typical recipient of any program, but I wonder if you could just kind of give us a picture, kind of following on Representative Grunhagen's question. You know, people might think that people could be on multiple programs, and I wonder if you could just sort of give us a picture of the kind of person who might be on this general assistance program. So it's my understanding this is kind of like the bottom line safety net that the state has for people who have no other source of income. Is that kind of accurate?
Madam Chair, I would say that, yes, that's fairly accurate. I think the vast majority of the people who receive assistance through this program are single adults with some type of a disability, and perhaps they haven't been able to get through the disability determination process to be able to receive one of the federal programs like SSI or something else like that. And so in the meantime, maybe they would be getting general assistance instead.
Okay. Thank you for that. And and Representative Neuer.
Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to inquire about the GRH program. I was going through the process. How is that related to the GA, or is that completely a separate program?
Ms. Pugnelli.
The program formerly known as GRH, or Group Residential Housing, it now has a different name. It's Housing Support Services, but that program specifically provides for payment of room and board in certain settings. And one of the categories of people that are eligible for that assistance is people that are on the GA program. So there is a link there.
Thank you. Representative Neuer? Okay. Thank you. Representative Munson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the length of time it takes to apply and receive funds. Representative Kanush Padin's story about having to go on this program because she was waiting for her license to be approved was interesting, because we run into people that have come into something and they lose their job, or they're trying to feed their families and get on assistance quickly. I know that the shutdown of the government was like 20 days long under Pawlenty, or 10 days under Dayton, so it was a pretty short period of time. But what's the length of time for the MFIP program or the GA program to get to apply and then to receive funds, or does it vary county by county?
Ms. Pugnelli?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I would guess that it probably does vary. There's a verification process that counties have to go through in order to verify a person's income and other eligibility criteria to make sure that they're actually eligible for the program. And I think maybe depending upon how complicated that might be, depending on the household, the time frame would vary. I don't know what the average is. I could ask DHS that question.
Okay.
Representative Munson.
Madam Chair, is it a matter of days, or is it like weeks that somebody would typically have to wait?
Ms. Pugnelli, if you know.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't want to speculate.
Okay.
Yeah, Representative Munson, I think that's a great question. Ms. Pugnelli, if you could find that out for us, they must have data on that. And mm-hmm. Would also be really interesting to know if there's a great deal of variation by county. So, good. Let's follow up on that. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just I just encourage everybody to go down to your county social services, which I did, and work with the people who keep track of all this. Okay. I wouldn't want that job, to tell you the truth. But there is a certain percentage of recipients that are very transient. In other words, they move around a lot, and it makes it very difficult to keep track of them. And I don't know exactly why they're moving. The workers had some opinions, but anyway, that was just statements at the time. But I don't think we've ever updated the county computer system, have we? I know we've talked about it a lot. It's archaic. When you watch these workers between the different screens, and I think in terms of efficiency, accountability, and making sure people actually that are eligible get the benefits, I think that maybe it's this year with a $1.5 billion surplus that we look at. I remember one other time, I think it was $30 million to upgrade. Now, that was several years ago. I'm sure it costs more now. But I do think those county workers should have an updated computer system. They're using DOS. I mean, things that I used in my office years ago, they're using that. And, we talk about fraud and waste in the system. Well, how do you keep track of these benefits and the people? I mean, some of them seem to play the system. Now, I don't think it's a large percentage, but they're moving around a lot, and they're hard to keep track of. That's the input I got from one of my counties when I visited.
Representative Grunhagen, thank you for that. I think that you are identifying something that is a huge challenge, and we, I think, will almost certainly have some requests for updating of that equipment, which I understand is extremely expensive. Probably that's why it hasn't happened up to this point. But I think you're identifying a very real problem. Just a comment about the surplus is that, you remember, it doesn't include inflation on anything. But also, we can only spend it once. Amen. So I just, with that comment, you know, we're going to have a lot of requests, and some of them, many of them, I think that members of this committee will find very, very important, and we will want to fund a lot of things, and we're going to have to make some awfully hard choices, even with the so-called surplus, which, of course, HHS may not get.
Amen.
So, yeah, Representative Grinhagen.
Yeah, and I agree with you completely. But this has been a request that has come a lot, and then we've had accusations of waste, fraud, and abuse in the system. And again, just encourage members on this committee to visit with you, go visit your local social workers that actually deal and administer with this, and look at the computer equipment that they're using. And I think a lot of the allegations, rightly or wrongly, about waste, fraud, and abuse could be resolved with updating this equipment. And we might be surprised. It could save millions of dollars in the system and help us to be able to help people who really need help more by having an updated computer system. That's just a general statement, food for thought for members to think about.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Grinhagen. Representative Neuer.
Madam Chair, Representative Grinhagen, I've actually managed that system. It's called Maxis. It's one of the most efficient systems that we have, although it may be an old system. It has got its own integrity. I can assure you that someone who has used that system for more than 14 years and managed for the statewide, it's a system that needs an update for sure. But at least we understand how it functions. There's accountability in that system. It's one of the most efficient system with stability that I can assure you. But changing that system to become to the up-to-date the way we use the current computing system is something that we ought to look into and increase that efficiencies for the counties.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Neuer. So we have an expert on our committee in that regard. And let's move on and go to the next section, which is slide 80, page 40.
Madam Chair and members, the next two programs that I'm going to be going through are Supplemental Security Income and Minnesota Supplemental Assistance. SSI is a federal program that provides cash assistance to aged, blind, and people with disabilities, and it's administered through local offices of the Social Security Administration using uniform nationwide standards. The Minnesota Supplemental Assistance or MSA program is a state program that provides supplemental cash assistance to needy, aged, blind, or people with disabilities who are SSI recipients or who would qualify for SSI except that they have excess income. In order to qualify for the federal SSI program, an individual must be age 65 or older, or blind, or have a disability according to criteria that's established by the Federal Social Security Administration, and the person must also meet income and asset limits and other eligibility criteria. And an individual's income after any allowed exclusions must be below the maximum monthly SSI benefit. A single SSI or MSA recipient can have no more than $2,000 in net counted assets after all allowable exclusions, and a married couple can have no more than $3,000 in net counted assets. Certain assets are excluded from consideration when calculating the value of assets. Those are things like homestead, value of one vehicle per household, and the value of household goods and personal effects up to an equity value of $2,000. One thing that I would note is for MSA recipients who are not also SSI recipients, the asset limit is different, and it mirrors the asset limit for MFIP and GA, which is the $10,000. The maximum monthly benefit for SSI for calendar year 2018 was $750 for an individual and a little over $1,100 for a married couple. The actual benefit that is received is the difference between the individual's net income after applying any of any allowed exclusions. And then the MSA cash grant is computed by subtracting any net countable income from the MSA asset standard. The SSI payment is counted toward an individual's net income under MSA. And for calendar year 2018, the MSA assistance standards were $811 for an individual and a little over $1,200 for a married couple. And this last slide on SSI and MSA just shows some funding and enrollment numbers for fiscal year 2018.
Excuse me a second. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make maybe a small comment about the income assistance housing program for SSI, slide 83. And I make this comment because in my district I have several senior housing, you know, and the issues that you hear with seniors about being alone, oftentimes they don't have other relatives to take care of them, but they're trying to do this on their own. And I was just looking at the amount of SSI or MSA, which is $750, and for a married couple it's $1,125. And what we're finding is that many are deciding not to get married or to occupy the same space because they're losing money. And for some, you know, $100, $200 is a difference in how they want to maintain their livelihood. So I think, you know, this is something, too, that we need to look at and address because I think we want to really encourage people, you know, if they decide that, you know, it's best for them to be in companionship or be married, to do that, even at that late age in life.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Hamilton.
To that point, I believe a couple years ago, and I'll look to staff to see if it was actually signed into law, but I remember carrying a bill that would allow an 18-month extension. I mean, if you got married to where those benefits didn't just automatically dropped off, there was 18 months there, kind of a, yeah, I think that passed, but I looked towards staff to see if that was actually signed in law.
Ms. Pugnelli?
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, that bill was enacted, but it was limited to the MFIT program, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Oh. Thank you, Ms. Pugnelli. Ideas for bills.
Yeah.
Other questions, members? Okay, let's continue.
Madam Chair and members, the next program that I'm going to go through are the child care assistance programs. Child care assistance programs receive federal, state, and county funds to subsidize the child care expenses of eligible families, including families participating in MFIP and working families or students who receive no cash assistance. And there are really three different sub-programs that we typically talk about as part of child care assistance programs, or CCAP. The first one is the MFIP child care assistance program. This program serves families who are receiving MFIP and participating in an authorized employment or education activity. The transition year child care assistance program is for families who are transitioning off of MFIP. And then the basic sliding fee child care assistance program is for low-income working families. I would also just mention here that the child care assistance programs need to meet federal requirements under the Federal Child Care Development Fund, and the Department of Human Services is required to periodically submit a plan to the Federal Department of Health and Human Services that provides for a variety of different things, including parental choice of providers, consumer education, compliance with state licensure requirements, and compliance with health and safety requirements.
And thank you. And Ms. Pugnelli, And these requirements, are those a condition of our receiving funding for CTAP, or what's the stick that the feds have for us to get us to comply with those rules?
Madam Chair, states are required to comply with the federal laws and regulations around Child Care Development Fund, which, as you know, was reauthorized in 2014. There were a lot of major changes that were made to the program at that time. Minnesota is still not in full compliance with the federal law as it was reauthorized, so that's something that we've been dealing with for a few years now. And the state could be penalized by the federal government. The Secretary of Health and Human Services has the authority to do that. We have not been penalized yet at this time. I don't know if they penalized us, what those penalties would be. I think the Secretary has broad authority to penalize us.
Okay. Thank you.
So once again, Madam Chair, this is another program that's administered by the counties under the supervision of the Department of Human Services. Parents who are eligible for assistance under this program may choose any type of legal child care, including legal unlicensed child care. Just to go into a little bit more detail on the MFIP Child Care Assistance Program, this subsidizes child care costs for families who participate in the statewide MFIP program, including families who choose to forego the cash portion of MFIP. Transition year child care, which is sort of a component of MFIP child care assistance, provides child care assistance for eligible families for the first 12 months after the family leaves MFIP. And this MFIP child care assistance is fully funded through the State General Fund, Federal Child Care Development Fund, and TANF funds.
And Ms. Pugnelli, there was a question here, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and actually it was just more of a comment that we've all heard a lot about early childhood, and Representative Pinto is going to be leading a real effort on that. But I think one of the key distinctions to understand behind this program and the other one that we hear a lot about that's there's discussions for modifying as well is the preschool scholarship program. And those early childhood scholarships are capped at an amount of $7,500 per year, per enrollee or per student or child. And that's, you know, less than half the cost of a typical preschool child care experience over the years. So this one is sliding fees, so it goes up as parents get raises, or if the family enlarges with another child or whatever. It's sliding fee, but it does allow for some continuity for that program, for that child, in terms of, and the parents in selecting a program. But the wait list has sometimes, I know in my county, been as long as multiple years.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Pugnelli?
Madam Chair, continuing on with slide 88, this is just a little bit more detail on the basic sliding fee child care assistance program. This provides a child care subsidy to working families who are not receiving cash assistance through MFIP. It's funded through the State General Fund, Federal Child Care Development Funds, Federal TANF funds, and county contributions. And this program, the assistance is limited by available funding. It's a capped allocation. So for this program, some counties do have waiting lists. The most recent waiting list that I looked at was from October 30th of 2018. At that time, there were 27 counties in Minnesota that had a waiting list, with a total of a little over 2,200 families on the waiting list. The next slide talks about CCAP eligibility. In order to be eligible for CCAP, a family must have an income at or below 47% of state median income at program entry and 67% of state median income at program exit. And they must have a child or children under the age of 13, participate in an authorized work training or education activity, cooperate with child support enforcement, and pay a co-payment based on family size and income. And as far as the co-payment goes, families with an income below 75% of the federal poverty guidelines do not have to pay a co-pay. Child care assistance program benefits. The benefit amounts under this program depends on the caretaker's activities, the selection of the child care provider, where the child care is provided, and the amount of the family co-payment. Maximum benefits under the program cannot exceed 120 hours of subsidized care in a two-week period for each eligible child. The maximum child care reimbursement rates are set in statute. They are based off of a market rate survey that was done in 2011, and the maximum rate that can be paid is the 25th percentile of those rates in each county and for each type of care and different categories for the ages of the children. And the other thing I would note on that is this is one of the areas where Minnesota is out of compliance with federal law right now. The reauthorized CCDF law requires that the reimbursement rates be based off of the most recent market rate survey, which I believe is the 2018 market rate survey. Another thing that I would note related to this program is that the Office of the Legislative Auditor is currently conducting a special investigation into this program because of some allegations of fraud that were made this past spring.
So, let's see. We've got, oh, Representative Franson.
And that is a really great segue, thanks, Ms. Pinelli, into I'm going to be authoring some bills related to the child care assistance fraud that's been happening, that's been in the news. It's not just happening in Minnesota. It's actually happening all across the nation. It's basically organized crime. There's cases of the same thing that's happening in Minnesota, that's happened in New York, that's happened in Australia even. And so I'm hopeful, Madam Chair, that you will take, you know, the bill seriously and have us hearing some hearings on this topic so that we can bring some integrity back into the program so that taxpayers know that their dollars are being used the way they're supposed to be used, and therefore we can recapture those dollars that are being taken fraudulently and lower those wait list down for the families that need the dollars.
Thank you, Representative Franson. It's our intention to look at all serious bills seriously. So we hope that we will certainly be considering this whole topic, I am sure. And I'll call on you just again in just 1 second. But I just wanted to flag for members, too, just to emphasize what Ms. Pugnelli just explained to us, that the rates that we pay are 25% of the rates that were being charged in 2011, right? So just imagine we talk a lot in here about how we're underpaying providers of health care and how hospitals are underpaid, or at least for what they'd like to be paid, right? We talk a lot about how public programs underpay. 25% of what the market rate was in 2011. And so even for the feds, that is out of compliance. So just so that we're, you know, clear, I think Ms. Pugnelli is trying to, like, raise a red flag here a little bit for us on our out-of-compliance issues with child care. So, right. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And regarding that your intention to hear serious bills, I think that's great. I'm not sure, you know, I mean, the idea of serious bills lies in the
the eye of the beholder, right? But fraud is a very serious issue, and I can guarantee you the bills that I will be bringing forward and that my colleagues will be bringing forward are very serious and that will deal with the nature at hand, which is the fraud in the child care assistance program and other public programs.
Thank you. Representative Munson, Moran, and then Baker.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some questions about the kind of the split for CCAP spending in Minnesota. I mean, this is a great presentation because we go through a lot of programs, and I mean, I'm a numbers guy, so I like to dig into where all the money's going. It's my intention to try to work in this committee so that we can protect, you know, those people who need it most and try to cut waste and fraud and abuse and stuff. And so I'd like to see some of the trending for the CCAP funds. Do you have a information on how CCAP is split, whether it goes to Head Start or private unlicensed providers or the center-based providers, and kind of the growth over time? Have you looked at kind of the different trends?
Ms. Bunielli.
Madam Chair and members, I might have Mr. Berg comment on this as well. I know the forecast document has a lot of historical data about appropriations broken out by funding source, so federal, state, county funding source for the MFIP Child Care Assistance Program and basic sliding fee. And DHS also does an annual report. I think it's called a family profile or something like that. I could get you the most recent report from their website that has a lot of data about the age of the children in care, what type of care they are attending, whether it's family or center-based care, and that type of thing, if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is there a parity for our uniformity in licensing or standards that the recipients of the CCAP funds have, whether it's Head Start or private child care provider or a center-based provider, or are they held to different standards?
Ms. Bunielli.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Representative Munson.
I read that private unlicensed providers receive CCAP funds. And is it the same dollar amount per child, per hour, whatever that works out to be? Are they held to the same licensing standards, the same safety, and the regulations that go along with it?
Ms. Bunielli.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, so the reimbursement rates are based off of that 2011 survey, and the rates are broken out by type of provider, so there would be different rates for family child care providers versus centers, for example, and then they're further broken out by age of the child, so there would be different rates for infant care versus school age care, for example. It's actually quite complicated. And the licensing standards, this is something that Sarah Sunderman would normally cover. I know that there are two different sets of rules in Minnesota rules. There's a chapter of rules for the family child care providers, and there's a different set of rules for the child care centers. And I would guess that the licensing standards are a bit different just because the settings are different. You're not going to have as many staff people in a family child care home versus a center. So I would guess that there would be differences just based off of sort of fundamental differences in the two types of settings.
So, Representative Munson, I bet this is one where there's a good publication on it, because this is a really complicated topic. And the licensing itself is probably more in Chair Moran's committee and Representative Pinto's committee as well.
Okay.
But it's a really important topic. I think I'm super glad that you're interested in this, because these are really difficult issues. And, of course, it impacts availability of child care and cost of child care, and all of that is all wrapped up together. But I bet that if you talk to Ms. Bunielli afterwards, I bet she could point out for you a good publication that would at least get you started and then direct you to maybe when Ms. Sunderman is back, you know, I bet she'd be happy to work with you a little more on this.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in regards to the low reimbursement rate, I mean, this is a really big issue. Not only are we out of the standards with the federal government, but the impact it is having on, like, daycare, child care providers is really, really huge. And it's huge for me in relationship to when we look at the necessity to have early childhood available for, like, low-income families, communities of color, so that kids are entering kindergarten grade and prepared reading by third grade. And I know within my own district, well, we have child care providers where, and I'm sure the same thing is done in the rural communities, where you want to have access to a local child care provider, whether they are a home daycare provider or in a public school or whatever that may be. I know when I visit daycare providers in my district, and I look at the population, and I talk to the business owner, she says to me is that, you know, it's really, really important that I'm able to really have a group of young people, people of, you know, of color, because we see the disparities within those communities. But the fact is, as a business owner, the rate is so low, I can't afford to do that. This is a business for me. And I am not able to have, you know, 15 young people taking this reduced rate because I have food, I have maintenance, I have different things that I have to do in order to allow my business to thrive. So it's really having a really, really big impact in those who have been serviced and for business owners who want to do the right thing or want to expand the population of their little people who is a part of their business, but just can't do it. So I know that I do believe that we will be seeing this bill moving through my committee because it has been an issue for a very, very long time, and we really need to get those rates up because the cost of child care is really out of whack with what that reimbursement rate is.
Thank you, Chair Moran. Okay, so we can continue.
Madam Chair and members, the next slide is slide number 91, and this provides some information on funding and enrollment for the child care assistance programs for fiscal year 2018. Madam Chair, if there aren't any other questions about child care, the next program that we can talk about are food support programs.
Sure.
There are two federally funded food support programs that I'll just go over quickly. The first one is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which was formerly known as food stamps. This is a federally funded program that's operated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and it provides food assistance to low-income individuals. This is a program that is administered by counties under the supervision of the Department of Human Services, but all of the requirements surrounding it are federal requirements, including the income and asset standards and other requirements for eligibility. The next program is the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program. It's also a federally funded program. It's administered through the Minnesota Department of Health and the counties, and it provides food support to low-income pregnant women and children under the age of 5. If there aren't any questions on the food support programs, we can...
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Pugnelli. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it's a question or something, but will we get a chance to discuss the shutdown and the impacts on SNAP and what we may or may not be needing to consider legislatively? I mean, just put a pin in that for if, when, that time. I know in other places we're having discussions in different committees about the impact the shutdown may have on
our work, so, but in this program in particular.
Yeah, Representative Olson, I know we had a hearing on that in Ways and Means recently, and I know the governor had a press conference on it. I haven't received anything from the administration yet, anything very specific, but I know that the governor is, you know, if it should happen that the shutdown starts taking food off people's tables, he is very interested in making sure that we do what we can to make sure that people don't go hungry in the state. I think probably lots and lots of us would support that. So you bet, if it comes to that, I'm sure we will be discussing that in this committee.
Madam Chair, the next slide is slide number 93, and we're moving on to the Housing Support Services Program, which was formerly known as Group Residential Housing, or GRH. This is a state-funded program that provides housing support services payments on behalf of eligible people for room and board and related housing services. And this is another program that's administered by counties under the supervision of DHS. In order to be eligible for housing support payments, an individual must have county approval for residence in a housing support setting and must meet one of three different categories of eligibility, either be aged, blind, or over 18 years of age and disabled and meet specific income and asset standards, belong to a category of individuals potentially eligible for general assistance and meet income and asset standards, or receive licensed residential crisis stabilization services and MA. This next slide, slide 95, is a pie chart showing for fiscal year 2018 the different types of housing settings where housing support services was provided. In order to receive payments, housing support payments, a setting has to have a certain type of licensure or registration with the Department of Health or Human Services. And so this is sort of an example of, for 2018, the different types of housing services providers. And as you can see, the biggest type of housing setting was adult foster care homes. The next slide.
One moment, please. Representative Commissioner Bean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you explain to us what these adult foster homes are, please? Thank you.
Ms. Pugnelli.
Madam Chair and members, adult foster care homes are home-like settings. There's both corporate and family adult foster care where a group of unrelated people who have disabilities or some other, you know, special needs would live together and have staff there that provide services to them to help them with their daily activities or what have you. They're licensed by the Department of Human Services.
Does that help? Yep. And since we're paused here, I guess I maybe this is the best time for me to ask my questions about this too before we move on to the income standards. So I'm just curious, Ms. Pugnelli, whether, you know, how the rates are set for this. Is this something that's done county by county? I know you said in your slide, I think 93, let's see. No, let's see, county approval for residents, that's on slide 94. I guess there's really nothing here that says how the rates are set. Is this something that is kind of like we used to do with the home and community-based services, done county by county, or are there standards, statewide standards?
Madam Chair, members, I believe slide 97, I'll talk a little bit about what the basic room and board rate is. It's currently $904 a month. There's a formula in statute that the Department of Human Services uses to establish that rate each year.
Okay, that's helpful. And then also a little bit of the same question as Representative Kunesh Padid. When we look at adult foster homes, and I usually think of that as being, you know, paid for out of different buckets, waivers and stuff like that, and this is a little different. Is there, are these some of the same providers that are just receiving for different clients? They're, different clients are maybe funded from different sources, but the providers could be the same, you know, they could be the same adult foster homes, for example, or the same, you know, housing with services providers?
Madam Chair, I think that that's correct. And speaking of the waivers, you asked a similar question yesterday, and I'm not sure I gave a very enlightening answer, so I'll try again today. The MA waiver services pay for services. MA doesn't allow for payment of room and board. So the waivers would cover services that people need, and then that could be paired with this housing support services program to pay for the room and board portion of the adult foster care or whatever other setting a person might be in. I think a good example is under the elderly waiver, a person could be receiving elderly waiver to pay for their services in an assisted living setting and then receive housing support services payments to pay for the room and board portion.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, what would be helpful to me, and maybe I have to check with my county, go back for another half-day education seminar, is to take actual cases without names or addresses or anything else and just say, here's this person's situation, these are the programs he qualifies for, and actually begin to add up what the total benefits are and if they're meeting the needs of that person or not. I don't know if we can get actual case examples. We probably need about a dozen of them to figure all the different if, ands, or buts in these programs. But, you know, you bring us the case example. Here's a family of four. They're in this income level, and here are the benefits they qualify for. It would help me as a layperson and as participating in this community to look at those, and maybe we need to adjust some of those programs or qualifications to make sure the people who need it really get it, and maybe there's excesses in some other qualifications. But just, and I do appreciate this packet. It's very well done. I appreciate whoever put that together. But to me, those types of examples, you know, help me as a layperson to better evaluate what's actually going on.
So, Representative Grunhagen, I think you have an excellent suggestion that would help us conceptualize this a lot better, because let's face it, you know, the reason it takes 2+ days just to go through this is because it's mighty complicated. There's a lot of different things going on here. I think you might be somewhat shooting the messenger here, you know, that House Research put together this packet for us just to give us an overview.
Yep.
But I really think it's a great suggestion you've made. And I wonder if, I think we have a county representative in the room, and maybe this would be something.
There might be
that
privacy.
The counties, just an example, like you say, de-identify, just pick out a case and explain sort of circumstances. If the, I don't know, is there a county person here that maybe if, anyway, I will push on that a little bit. I think the counties might be the best place to ask for that. Maybe DHS, I'm not really sure, but, you know, maybe I'll ask Mr. Wirth to make a note, or actually Krista's making the note already, I see. So we'll try to get that to happen, because I think it would really be instructive for all of us. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Oh, and I'm sorry. I had to stop again because I didn't get all the questions here. Representative Hamilton.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. We asked for that information here a while back, and they provided us with a very nice chart of specifically what Representative Grunhagen is asking or requesting. So I know it's available somewhere, because we've seen it in the past.
Ms. Bunielli, do you know what that might be?
Madam Chair and members, I think we have put together in the past maybe a list of all of the programs with the income eligibility that might show or be able to tell from that what programs a person could potentially be eligible for. I think also in the past we have received information from DHS on sort of examples of cases.
Okay, so maybe it sounds like she doesn't exactly have something in mind, but if, you know, Ms. Pugnelli, maybe if you could kind of take that back and think about it, that if there's something already, we don't want to reinvent the wheel on it. And I have Representative, well, to that point, Representative Laffer, because then Representative Noor wants to say something.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to suggest, as long as we're saying what would be useful, I think since we're the Finance Committee, it would be really useful to get some insights on the trends as well. And I think we should get it maybe from both DHS and the counties, because I think it may vary. They look at it statewide, where the issues of rural counties may be different than those in the metro. But I do think that with the increased cost of housing, I think a lot of these programs are under a lot of financial pressure, and a lot of people who maybe wouldn't have applied for MSA or housing support in the past are now doing that just because the costs of the basics of just room and board have gone up so much.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion as well. Representative Neuer.
Just, Madam Chair, along the same lines, we can have the DHS staff come and walk us through a real case without having a situation that we have to deal with privacy. They will have to create a unique case that we can go through the process. I'm willing to sit down with you and go to the DHS and get us up to date. Give us a scenario.
I'd like to talk to you after the meeting.
Absolutely, let's do that. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and Representative Noor, I think you're probably right. You know, it's either going to be the counties or DHS who are going to be able to do this for us. But it's great you guys talk, because it'd be great. But I think it would be useful for the whole committee to have that as well. And, we're just really in our second meeting. And actually, it's quite exciting to me that you all are so interested in this, because we need to dig down into this for sure. Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just one other concern I promised to bring to the attention of the committee from my social workers back in one of the counties I represent. They just said it would be nice. They got one family, yet they have to put the families on multiple different programs. So sometimes two of the children will go on one program, another child goes on this program. And they said if there's some way to simplify that, so that we can keep a family on a similar program, it would be greatly appreciated at the trench level.
Well, Representative Grunhagen,
I promised to share that. So
yeah, thank you. And you know what? Honestly, my county, Olmsted County, is a very creative, forward-thinking county, I believe. And they have, and some other counties have been working together, and there are some really good, creative new ideas to do pretty much what you just described. So maybe we'll hear about that this session as well. I mean, that would be really outstanding. So I'm glad we're
bipartisan.
Yeah, no, well, we, in fact, we are, and people often don't believe this, people outside this place, but in fact, we share an awful lot more than what divides us. We may have differences about how to approach something, but I think the basic idea, people don't come on this committee if they don't care about, people's needs in the state. So I think there's a lot to work with here. Anyway, please continue.
Madam Chair and members, slide 96 talks about housing support income standards. For an individual who is aged blind or over 18 years old and disabled according to the criteria used by the Social Security Administration, that person would be eligible for housing support if they had income below the housing support monthly rate that's specified in a county's agreement with a housing support provider. For a person who belongs to a category of individuals potentially eligible for GA, they would have to meet the countable income standards under the GA program minus the MA personal needs allowance. And then also meet the GA asset standard. Nearly all housing support recipients qualify for the housing support basic room and board rate of $904 per month, and some recipients in certain housing support settings may also qualify for a supplemental payment that's in addition to that base rate. And the last slide on housing support is just funding and enrollment for fiscal year 2018. And this may be a good stopping point, Madam Chair. The next several slides are all things related to Sarah's subject area.
Okay, Ms. Puniele, are there any questions? Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you use the term room and board, I think that it means housing and food. Is that what room and board means?
Madam Chair, Representative Kunesh-Podein, yes.
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you. So when a person were to receive $904 in basic room and board, is it broken up by X amount of dollars for room and X amount of dollars for board? And is this for those kind of group home settings? Is that what we're talking about? And so is it a set rate for each resident at like an all-inclusive amount?
Ms. Puniele?
Madam Chair, Representative Kunesh-Podein, I'm not aware that there are separate amounts for room versus board, and it is for settings like foster care, housing with services, board and lodge facilities. So these are all licensed or registered facilities.
Okay. Other questions on that? So we are at the end of our time here, so it would make sense for us to pause. I know, that went by fast. For me, it did. Let's see. So we have other sections left here, and Ms. Puniele, will you be able to cover them? I think we have them continuing on our next agenda. So we don't have to. Yeah, so I think then we'll pause here with this, and thank you very much for your presentation to both of you, and to Mr. Chun as well. We really appreciate it. And there being no other business before the committee right now, we are adjourned.